From Albany, New York, this is Public Health Radio. On today's program, we bring you an interview with author and journalist Jeff Goodell about the impact of coal on public health. We'll explore the devastating effects of coal mining on Appalachian communities, from the toxic effects of coal on water supplies to worker safety, as well as the harmful byproducts of coal combustion, including air pollutants that harm human health and greenhouse gas emissions that impact climate change. We'll talk with Jeff about what he calls our shiny white iPod economy propped up by dirty black coal rocks and discover why coal is ultimately harmful to the public's health. But first, some news from the world of public health. First trimester abortion is now legal in Mexico City, while abortions after the first trimester will be more likely to be illegal in the United States after a Supreme Court ruling. Each year in Mexico, nationwide, there are about 200,000 illegal abortions, and at least 8,000 Mexican women die annually of complications from illegal, unsanitary abortions. Representing a metropolis among the largest on the planet, and in the face of the official opposition of the Pope and the Catholic Church, the Mexico City Legislative Assembly voted overwhelmingly in favor of legalizing abortions during the first 12 weeks of pregnancy in late April 2007. During the previous week, in April 2007, the United States Supreme Court upheld a ban on so-called partial birth abortions, endorsing language broad enough to outlaw abortions as early as 12 to 15 weeks of gestation. The president of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Dr. Douglas W. Lobby, called the Supreme Court decision, quote, "shameful and incomprehensible to those of us who have dedicated our lives to caring for women. It leaves no doubt that women's health in America is perceived as being of little consequence," unquote. Last fall, Dr. Lobby described the term partial birth abortion as, quote, "purposely contrived to be inflammatory." While proponents of this law say that it addresses a particular procedure, it has been specifically written to describe and encompass elements of other procedures used in obstetrics and gynecology, end quote. Social conditions in Iraq continue to deteriorate. 4 years after the shock and awe invasion by the United States of America and its coalition of the willing, Iraqi children have the lowest rate of survival of any nation in the world, with 12% dying before they reach 5 years of age due to many preventable causes, including violence, dehydration, and treatable infections, among them cholera. More than 250,000 children have received no vaccinations since the March 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq. Over two-thirds of the people in Iraq have no access to safe drinking water. Presently, 50,000 Iraqis become new refugees every month. And over 4 million people, more than 1 in 7 Iraqis, have already become refugees from the war. At the beginning of 2007, it was widely reported that of the 34,000 doctors in Iraq in 2003, 12,000 had fled the country and 2,000 had been killed. A front-page story in the New York Times on May 10, 2007, entitled "Psychiatrists, Children, and the Drug Industry's Role," reported that drugs in the class of, quote, "atypical antipsychotics," end quote, are now being prescribed to over 500,000 children in the United States. The authors of the article looked at the payments to psychiatrists by drug companies in Minnesota, the only state in the United States that requires public disclosure of drug company payments to doctors. The authors reported that drug company payments to Minnesota psychiatrists in 2005 were 6 times greater than what they had been in 2000. Meanwhile, the number of prescriptions for antipsychotic medications for children in Minnesota's Medicaid program in 2005 was 9 times greater than it was in 2000, and the cost of antipsychotics for children receiving Medicaid benefits in Minnesota rose from $521,000 in 2000 to over $7.1 million in 2005. The Times reported that Minnesota psychiatrists who received at least $5,000 from companies that sell atypical antipsychotic drugs seem to have written at least 3 times as many prescriptions for atypical antipsychotics for children as doctors who took less or no money. Welcome to Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Elaine Hills. Today on Public Health Radio, we take a close look at the issue of coal. Coal has long been associated with a host of health and environmental problems. By the mid-20th century, air pollution inversions gave fame to cities like London, England, and Denora, Pennsylvania, where killer fogs were found, after the concentration of pollutants from coal power production hovered overhead and killed thousands. Despite the long history of deaths and health problems resulting from coal, it remains a widely used energy source, and today is on the rise. But the health effects of coal have certainly not diminished. We now associate coal with some of the world's worst job conditions. The hazards of coal are also felt by our wider society. In recent decades, public health researchers have clearly documented connections between the air pollutants produced by coal and a range of health effects, including premature mortality, stunted growth in children, and increased incidence of asthma attacks. Coal power plants are also a major emitter of carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas most widely known for producing climate change. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports that in order to reduce the speed at which humans change the global climate, we must decrease our dependence on coal for electricity production. Today on Public Health Radio, we explore many of these public health issues related to coal. Our guest today is author and journalist Jeff Goodell. Jeff is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. He is an author of 2 in-depth and important books about the coal industry, including the New York Times bestseller, Our Story, 77 Hours That Tested Our Friendship and Our Faith, which was published in 2002 and based on the terrifying hours 9 Q Creek miners spent trapped underground. His most recent book, Big Coal, published in 2006, reveals what Jeff calls the dirty secret behind America's energy future. We began our interview by asking Jeff to tell us how he became interested in the coal industry.
In spring of 2001, the New York Times Magazine called me to ask me to go to West Virginia to look into the comeback of the coal industry. And it was just around the time that the Bush-Cheney energy plan had been rolled out not long after the election. And it was clear that there was going to be a lot of coal in America's future. And this was a surprise to everyone, especially to me. I went to West Virginia, and until I got there, I had really never seen coal before. What I saw when I got to West Virginia was quite shocking. The first thing, of course, was the enormous mountaintop removal mines there that are scarring the landscape in southern West Virginia, and these just enormous mines where they blast apart the mountains and dump the overburden, they call it, into the riverbeds and then get the coal out of the ground that way instead of tunneling it like they used to do. And then I also saw, you know, a lot of poverty. The poverty in the coal fields was really striking to me. And that, in addition to the air pollution, West Virginia has some of the worst air in America, and it's directly related to coal. So I ended up writing my story for the New York Times, and it ran as a cover story in the magazine in summer of 2001. But I realized that I had just touched the surface on the implications of our dependence on coal, and thought it would be something to explore in a book. So I spent the next 3 years working on that.
What would you say was the effect on West Virginian communities that you visited when, you know, you said you witnessed this mountaintop removal for mining coal, this newer method really of mining coal? What impact did that have on those local communities?
It had tremendous impact. I ended up spending, you know, on that first trip, several weeks in the coal fields, and I was stunned by the poverty that I saw. You know, if coal were the ticket to prosperity, people in West Virginia should be dancing on gold-paved streets. They've had about 14 billion tons of coal has been hauled out of the ground there, and yet the state is at the bottom of just about every socioeconomic indicator that there is. Education, public health, cancer rates, lots of things, that West Virginia is near the bottom. And so I started to wonder, where is this prosperity that comes from these enormous mines? And you see these communities that are just being blasted apart in order to get this coal out of the ground. It's a really heart-wrenching scene. Some of these communities are near these big mines are severely impacted by it. I mean, I went into one person's house. You could actually see the coal coming out of the faucet. It was like black sludge coming out of the faucet. That was unusual, but more common is the release of heavy metals, which have health impacts of kidney problems and all kinds of things. Things like, you know, arsenic levels and cadmium and things like that that are released out of the ground when the coal is taken away.
And a lot of people in these communities really rely on the coal industry for a means of making an income.
They do. And, you know, that's something that is partly a product of the remote geography of these regions where the coal is. But a much larger part of it is the fact that over the last 100, 150 years, the coal industry has worked very hard to make sure that there have been no competing industries in these regions. You go all the way back to the old company stores where they would give the coal miner script that they could only spend in the company store, and they've worked very hard to keep other industries out. And so the people who live there, who are many of them very connected to the land, many of them been there for generations, love where they live, and if they want to support their family with a job, they basically have three choices. You know, they can go to work in a coal mine, at a coal mine, they can go to work at Walmart, or they can go to work at a prison. And a lot of them choose to go to work in the coal mines. And it's the best paying job in the region often, but it's also by far the most dangerous and the most destructive to the community.
Are there benefits such as medical care and other, you know, maybe retirement or things like that, that people who work in this industry stand to gain?
Well, you know, there are better and worse companies to work for. Some of them do have a good record of taking care of their workers and do offer health care plans and things like that. And some of them are tremendously exploitive and not much better than the old coal barons back at the turn of the century. So it runs the gamut. What's clearly happened, though, is the unions have been busted out of there, so there's not much of a union operations at all in these regions. And so workers really have not a lot of protection from dangerous conditions. You know, I went into a couple of, especially the underground mines. The irony is that the more dangerous the mine is, in general, the less the pay is and the less good the benefits are. They tend to be small operators, kind of almost fly-by-night coal operators who open these small mines and are trying to get the last bit of the coal out of the ground. And these are the guys, when you go down in there with those guys, you know, they're taking their lives in their hands every day when they go in there. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time in these little mines, and these guys just get banged up, and, you know, black lung is still a problem. The industry likes to deny it, but it's still a problem. And it's, you know, one of the most hazardous jobs in America, up there with crab fishing in Alaska.
Now, it seems to me that one of the things unions can offer if jobs are unionized, is additional safety and protection for workers, whether it be through particular standards that workers have to, and the companies that workers are employed by, standards that they have to adhere to, or maybe offering particular safety equipment that workers have to wear. Would you say that because there has been such a lack of union representation for coal miners, that their occupational safety has been sacrificed as a result?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And it's not only the fact that the labor unions have gone away, but also the fact that the Mine Safety and Health Administration, which is the federal regulatory agency that is supposed to look after the safety and welfare of coal miners, has been significantly weakened, especially under the Bush administration. And so the frequency of mining inspections has gone down. There tends to be less punishment, less enforcement actions, and more of a sense of allowing coal operators to get away with things. You know, but that said, one of the things that has happened that has made coal mining statistics look good, when you look at injury rates and death rates over the last 20 years or something, is that more and more of the coal mining is shifting to above ground, to these enormous strip mines, the mountaintop removal mines that I mentioned earlier. And so there's fewer and fewer and fewer people working under in the underground mines, which are the real dangerous ones. But the irony is that these enormous strip mines, which are the least dangerous for the workers and really not much more dangerous than any kind of heavy construction job, because it's all done with big machinery, big drag lines and tractors and dump haul trucks and things like that. It's less dangerous for the workers, but much more dangerous for communities. It's, you know, blowing apart communities, causing flooding because of the ripping apart of the mountains. And the big issue of heavy metals into water supply in coal mining regions, which has had significant health effects to the communities around. And, you know, it's a real issue in this area, but it's also, like many things around coal and air pollution and mining and everything, there's really not much interest in studying it. And so the statistics are hard to come by. A lot of it's anecdotal. There's a few determined and brave scientists at local universities who are looking into it, but, you know, nobody wants to really study it very closely because they're essentially afraid of what they might find.
And what does the anecdotal evidence say from your research? Have you talked to people who think that they have experienced health effects in their community that are associated with these heavy metals being leached into the water?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a town in West Virginia called, small community called Williamson, which is not far from the Kentucky border. You know, maybe it is a community of 1,000 people or something like that. Typical kind of small town, a small hollow community in West Virginia, and I spent a couple of days speaking with residents there and talked with two women with cancer, one woman with severe liver problems, a lot of children with attention deficit disorder, and every one of them convinced that it was coming out of their water. Many of them had their water supplies tested and had seen elevated levels of metals in their water. And even, in fact, the coal industry the coal company that has the mines in that region sort of admitted responsibility and, in fact, has brought in a kind of large tanker truck for fresh water for the community to drink. But you know, proving cause and effect on these kinds of illnesses, as you know, is very, very difficult. And these are, in general, very poor communities, not highly educated people who feel confident fighting against the coal industry, and it's a really difficult situation.
And in the case of Williamson, have there been any scientific studies? You've mentioned several different types of health ailments that people think are associated with coal, but has anybody actually been able to study that scientifically in that community?
Well, they're doing it now. There's a professor at north of there. It's a small university, and he's quite a great guy who is really taking this up as a cause and is studying it now. And there have been studies done by the coal company, of course, that have been funded by the coal company, that say that these metal levels are still within safe parameters, but no one trusts these studies. And it's the kind of thing that a number of coal country activists are trying to raise money to do better studies, but it's right now, it's still just anecdotal.
Yeah, and this is certainly one of the challenges of working within public health. It, you know, we don't just have an endless supply of money to carry out these sorts of studies. And so we see, especially in the last probably two decades, we've seen much, much more funding for public health research come from the very industries who may be perpetrating the so-called public health crime that it is we're investigating. So it makes for, you know, a very challenging time for researchers and the media and the general public to interpret what sort of evidence we have before us and whether or not that evidence is really objective or not.
Absolutely, and especially in the case of these small communities where, you know, you have big corporations essentially doing the damage and you have, you know, a relatively small number of people that are impacted by it and impacted in a way that even with good science is difficult to really draw solid cause and effect links. And so there's all kinds of pressure and feeling of, you know, well, it's too bad and we feel very bad for these people, but, you know, it's sort of the price of progress or the price of a healthy economy in West Virginia. That's how a lot of the people feel there. And there's just not a lot of urgency about doing anything about this. And this is the same story that is told throughout, you know, places like West Virginia, where you have an enormously influential industry that essentially owns and operates the state and has owned and operated the state for 150 years. You know, there's just no political will at all to really do anything to really look into these problems in any significant way or to rein in the industry. And that's where, you know, federal government has to come in because they're supposedly the ones who can overrun this sort of the power of the coal industry within the state. But that's been lacking lately also.
So what has the federal government been doing in recent years? I know we've heard, especially since the Bush administration came into power in 2000, that there have been initiatives such as Clear Skies, is it? Mm-hmm. And you know, other permutations of that, and some of that has related directly to the coal industry. So has this helped increase regulations of harmful emissions from the coal industry?
The Bush administration has made no secret of the fact that it has been very friendly to the coal industry. You know, right after Bush was elected in 2000, the Wall Street Journal ran a front page story saying essentially that, you know, West Virginia was what gave Bush the electoral votes he needed to win, of course, you know, with Florida after the Florida recount. And he was the first Republican to carry West Virginia in 30-some years. And so he owed a big debt to West Virginia and to the coal industry, and he's clearly been working to pay that back. And you've seen it throughout the sort of life cycle of coal, from rolling back restrictions on mountaintop removal mining to rolling back restrictions on air pollution, allowing there's a very complex legal battle called New Source Review, which essentially was about whether new pollution controls needed to be installed on old power plants. And the Bush administration fought very hard to undercut those regulations and allow these dirty coal plants to keep going longer and longer. And then all the way up to global warming with carbon dioxide emissions and their failure to do anything about that. I think that's clear and obvious that Bush has been a really good friend of the coal industry, and there's been really no significant effort to do anything about public health issues related to coal under this administration.
Do you think that the policies that the administration has enacted have actually rolled back some of the public health protections that may have initially been in place in terms of protecting the public from detrimental effects of coal?
Oh, yeah. To take two of the simplest examples, one is of the with this mountaintop removal mining that I've been talking about. They basically, by changing a few words in the regulations, were able to roll back protections from dumping what they call the overburden or the blasted apart mountain into streams. There had been protections requiring a 150-foot buffer from any streams that they could dump this overburden into. Well, they were able to, by changing a few words in the regulations, get rid of that and essentially fill in about 800 miles of streams in Appalachia that has had a big impact on the water supply in those regions and is really helping to really destroy the ecosystem there in what was once one of the great sort of freshwater regions of America. So by changing a few words in these regulations that govern mountaintop removal mining, they are able to essentially set loose this big coal boom throughout Appalachia. That's one example. The other example is of this New Source Review, which required the installation of scrubbers that remove sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide, which are the main pollutants that cause smog and health effects from coal plants. They've managed to put these rules off and allow these plants to continue burning coal without scrubbers for, you know, 5 or 6 years, when they should have had to clean them up, with significant health effects. I mean, you can clearly draw the line from the rollback of these regulations to premature deaths and asthma and air pollution problems in the regions around these plants. So, yes, I mean, there's no question that there's a direct cause and effect from the political actions of the Bush administration to the public health.
What do you think are the possibilities in the future for regulation from the federal level? Do you think there is hope for that, or are there actions happening at the state level that might help override some of these rollbacks federally?
There has been some action in the courts. This rollback of the regulations against putting the pollution controls on the dirty coal plants just suffered a significant defeat a few weeks ago in a federal court. And so I think eventually the courts are going to uphold the regulations and force these companies to clean these plants up to some degree. And I also think that these plants are reaching the end of their lifetime and will, within the next 5 or 6 years, 10 years, some of the worst of them will be shut down anyway, because they're just essentially getting worn out. I think the question is for the future is, are we going to build a whole nother generation of coal plants that will significantly impact, you know, both the air pollution and the destruction of Appalachia from the coal mining, or are we going to shift to cleaner renewable forms of energy? I think that's the real question as we move forward.
And currently, is Appalachia the predominant area that we're finding coal from in the United States?
We get about 60% of the coal from Appalachia, which is actually a declining percentage. The real mother load of coal in America is in Wyoming, in the Powder River Basin, which is in the northeastern corner of the state, not far from the South Dakota border. And there you have enormous reserves of coal that are relatively close to the surface and in 60 or 70 foot seams, much simpler to get at. In Appalachia, you know, you're lucky if you have a 6 or 7 foot thick seam of coal, and many of them are even smaller than that, because they've been mining coal in Appalachia, of course, for 150 years, so all the simple, easy-to-get stuff is gone. And the future, so, is really going to be coming out of places like Wyoming, and to some extent, there's still a lot of coal in Illinois also. In a way, getting coal out of Wyoming is a much happier story, because you don't have these enormous mountains that are being blown up. No one really lives out where the coal is being mined. There's not a lot of public health impacts out there. But one of the problems is, as coal gets depleted out of Appalachia, which is happening pretty rapidly, the destruction gets greater, because the coal they're going after is more deeply buried and more difficult to get at. So they have to blow up more mountains or tunnel more deeply underground, which makes it more dangerous and hazardous for the miners. So you get into a kind of vicious feedback cycle where, you know, the next 10 or 20 years of coal mining, if we keep up our dependence on coal, is going to be hugely destructive to Appalachia.
It looks like they're still going to continue to dig deeper in Appalachia and perhaps go into Wyoming and elsewhere?
Absolutely. There's a number of reasons for that. One of them is that, you know, the railroad transportation from Wyoming is very expensive. You know, they burn Wyoming coal as far as western border of Appalachia, but once you get into the sort of real heart of the Rust Belt and the real heart of coal country, that's all still Appalachian coal, and it's going to be hard to imagine that the railroads could deliver it into that region from Wyoming for any kind of cost-effective basis. So the Appalachian coal is basically going to continue until it gets either so expensive that nobody wants to burn it anymore, or they just blast the hell out of West Virginia, and there's nothing really left to get. You know, there are projections that, you know, within 40 years, essentially all of southern West Virginia and parts of Kentucky will essentially be one enormous strip mine and just be what the people in West Virginia call a national sacrifice zone to our addiction to coal.
You're listening to an interview by Elaine Hills of Jeff Goodell, the author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. In a moment, we'll return to that interview.
Is used to fuel about half of the energy production in the United States, correct?
Half of the electricity production.
Electricity production, okay.
Right.
Are there coal power plants in every state in the United States?
No, there aren't coal power plants in every state. There's coal power plants in about 33 states, I think it was the last count that I saw. But even states that don't have coal plants in the states themselves often import power from coal. For example, California is very proud of themselves as being a coal-free state, and there are no coal plants in California. And, you know, the Californians use a lot of hydroelectric power and a lot of natural gas and some wind and like to think of themselves as leading the charge on renewables, which is, of course, a good thing. They also import about 20% of their power comes from big coal plants in New Mexico and Nevada and surrounding regions. So, with the possible exception of Hawaii and maybe Washington State, which is almost entirely hydro, every state in the country uses some coal.
Coal is used for electricity generation all over the world, not just in the United States. And there's been an increasing amount of press, and particularly in the public health literature, about coal use in China. From the occupational point of view, you point out in your book that more than 6,000 workers a year are killed in China's coal mines. And there have been, over the last two decades particularly, a number of studies about the air pollution effects in China, I believe a significant amount of which comes from coal. So this is on the rise throughout the world, and especially in some of the more densely populated areas of the world.
Oh, yes. China is, you know, the textbook example of this, because China's enormous economic engine that's revving up in China is almost entirely coal-fired. I've had a number of trips to China, and, you know, the air pollution there is just among the worst in the world. And it's very difficult to get accurate numbers on premature deaths related to air pollution, but the World Bank did a study a couple of years ago that I think something close to 400,000 people a year dying prematurely in China and South Korea from the effects of air pollution from coal plants. In China, it's getting so bad that it's actually the environmental degradation that comes from a lot of things, but mostly from their dependence on coal, is becoming a real political issue in it. And China obviously is still nominally a communist country, and the notion that, you know, people are essentially getting rich in China by burning this filthy fuel and sacrificing the lives of a lot of people, both in the coal mines and from the air pollution, is a very politically charged situation. There have been riots about air pollution in coal plants in China. There have been riots about worker safety in coal mines. And it's one of the things that could potentially destabilize the political power in China right now.
And of course, what happens in China, both in terms of the political ramifications of using coal, but also the environmental ramifications of using coal, has a direct impact on what happens elsewhere in the world, including in the United States, especially in this day of age, we're thinking a lot about global climate change.
Right. The developing world's addiction to coal is, you know, a huge problem going forward when you think about how we're going to begin to deal with global warming and how we're going to begin to deal with cutting CO2 emissions, because Of course, we're not doing a very good job of it here in America either, but when you look at the developing world, is essentially, you know, greenhouse gases as far as the eye can see. And this is a problem not only for the obvious reasons that, you know, it will heat up the climate and, you know, lead to, as some climate scientists say, life on a different planet, but the public health impacts of that, of desertification, of changing water supplies, of food shortages and things, is enormous, and in fact dwarfs the problem of air pollution and all of these other things. And that is the real danger of coal, from a public health point of view, is, you know, these macro changes in the Earth's climate and rising sea levels, and essentially putting the stability of the Earth's climate in jeopardy just so that we can have cheap electricity.
And my understanding is that today the U.S. is more dependent on coal than we ever have been before. You know, even though we see that this is a fossil fuel that's on the decline, really, you've mentioned how in Appalachia in the next 40 years we might see a real major depletion of the sources of coal there. Nevertheless, we're using it more than we ever have before.
Yeah. The problem is, of course, is that we're using it in a way that most people don't know. I mean, it's not like in the 19th century, you know, there was the coal delivery truck that rattled down the street and everybody got their coal dumped into their basement and everyone knew what coal was and they knew exactly how much they used and they knew where it came from, and they saw the smoke and they saw the soot and they got their hands dirty and they knew it was very much a part of their lives. Today, you know, 50% of our electricity comes from coal. The average American burns 20 pounds of coal a day to keep their lights on in their house. This is throughout the country. But we have no idea, because instead of burning it, you know, in our furnaces or in our basements, we are burning it in these enormous power plants that are located in most places away from the eye, where the eye can see, or where most people, you know, will come across it in their ordinary lives. So we have no idea where this comes from. We just turn our lights on and just think that these electrons just kind of come flowing into the wall through magic. And we don't realize that this addiction to coal is, I don't mean to overstate it, but it's almost suicidal. And when you look at it from a global perspective and the consequences of this indulgence that we have on coal, I think that almost every serious climate scientist today would argue or would agree that the most urgent problem, if you want to think about how to make life on a sustainable planet here and how to stave off the worst of the effects of global warming, is to get a handle on coal and to begin to reduce emissions from coal. I think that, you know, everything else, you could get, you know, everyone in China and everyone in America to drive Toyota Priuses and to turn their thermostats down to 55 and to recycle every bottle they have, and it wouldn't make a damn bit of difference if we don't stop burning coal.
My understanding is that coal does result in this idea that some people are talking about these days of a carbon footprint. So coal has carbon dioxide emissions, but part of what makes coal so detrimental is that there are so many other emissions that come along with carbon dioxide out of coal, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides and things like that, but also the effects of mercury and other heavy metals that come along with that.
Sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide, they contribute, of course, to the health impacts of our dependence on coal, and they are, you know, obviously not a good thing from a health perspective. But from a global warming perspective, the odd thing is that the soot and sulfur dioxide pollution that comes out of coal plants acts as a reflector in the atmosphere and is actually helping to stave off some of the more immediate effects of global warming, because it essentially mirrors some of the sunlight back out into space. And so when we clean up these coal plants, as we need to do to save lives, essentially, of people who live near them and who are breathing in these soot particles, as we clean up the plants, we will in fact magnify global warming, because you will take some of this soot out of the atmosphere and it will allow more heat from the sun to get in. Just last week I was in Oslo, Norway, to talk with James Lovelock, a very eminent climate scientist and the originator of something called the Gaia theory, about the idea that the Earth works as an entire system. And he described the predicament we're in right now as a fool's climate, because when we clean up the coal plants, we're going to accelerate global warming by taking soot out of the air. And essentially, no matter whatever we do, it's going to get worse, not better. He thinks that we're going to need to begin to take large-scale kind of emergency measures to try to stabilize the climate. And one of the things that he and others have proposed is actually putting sulfate particles into the atmosphere deliberately, using various methods. One of them that they talk about is high-altitude jets, which would essentially put sulfate particles out into the stratosphere for the purpose of reflecting sunlight away from the Earth to essentially cool it off. So a weird paradox of our dependence on coal is that it's helping to cool the planet in the short term, but killing us as it does it.
So even a solution such as that you just described, that Lovelock proposes, of perhaps using these high-altitude jets, would maybe help to cool the planet, but again, would be another way of impacting human health more in the short term.
Well, the upside of it is that it wouldn't, because the soot that comes out of, and the particulate matter that comes out of, you know, it comes out of the stacks, which are, you know, depending on the plant, 500-600 feet high, gets lifted by the winds and carried, you know, regionally around, but settles out pretty quickly, and that's when we breathe it in, and that's why the health effects are significant. And the health effects are also significant because when coal burns, coal is a very complex rock that has a lot of metals in it. And in fact, most coal has every element in the periodic table in it. It's a very fascinating and complex material. But what happens when it's burned is that these metals are essentially liquefied by the heat. And when they go up in the stacks, they cool and they glom onto these sulfate particles and kind of attach to them like Velcro. And we breathe them in. So the reason that the particle matter is so dangerous is that they come into our lungs with hitchhikers of arsenic and cadmium and mercury and other nasty things that are no good for the human body attached to them. With the proposal that Lovelock and others are suggesting of distributing sulfate particles high in the stratosphere, because they'll be doing it way up there, 45,000 feet or higher, they have to use very few particles in order to get enough reflection to do the job. And also, they could create these particles without the heavy metals attached, essentially, to them. So they would be much safer particles, and the rain out down to the Earth would be minuscule compared to what we already have from coal plants and, to a lesser degree, automobiles.
Hmm. You've talked in your book about how in the past 20 years, the air pollution alone that comes out of coal plants has shortened lives of more than 500,000 people in the United States. And that, of course, is just looking at this country without even thinking on a more global scale, where certainly there are massive health effects of coal.
With coal, one of the problems of these deaths from air pollution is we know that air pollution in significant quantities kill people. We saw that in famous killer fogs of London in the 50s, and also where I think something like 5,000 to 6,000 people were killed in a matter of days from huge amounts of air pollution caused by a atmospheric inversion that kept all the coal smoke over London. And a similar thing happened in Pennsylvania in the 50s also. And no one debates that high levels of air pollution kills people. What is debatable or debated is what level of low air pollution or lower levels, where is the threshold, and is there a threshold of pollution that doesn't cause damage or doesn't essentially kill people? And that is the complex issue that is out there. And when you get to lower levels, you can show, people like Joel Schwartz at Harvard and others have shown the impacts of lower levels of pollution over these broad studies. But in any one particular case, it's very difficult to say that this person who just had a heart attack had it because he or she lived 10 miles from a coal plant and the air pollution for the last 3 weeks had been particularly bad, and that there's a link here. So there's endless deniability, you know, within the industry, and there's endless fighting not only about the level of air pollution that causes mortality, but also the kind of air pollution. The coal industry will argue that the pollution from coal plants is essentially benign and that the pollution from automobiles is what is the real killer. And they'll make arguments for the chemical mix of the air pollution from automobiles or any kind of vehicle being different from the chemical mix of air pollution from coal plants and why it's more dangerous. And it goes on and back and forth. And so there's all this fighting about who's got the most dangerous particle out there and who's really, you know, the one that's killing people. So from a perspective of trying to do something about this on a public health level, you know, you get into all of these arcane arguments very quickly that make it very difficult for legislators to move forward on reducing pollution levels.
And my understanding is that another major factor that's emitted out of coal is mercury, and that there has been a wealth of information that's shown the public health impacts of mercury, particularly affecting the nervous system and you know, impairing people's, basically their brains.
Right.
And so can you talk a bit about how much mercury is produced from our use of coal, and how does that compare to other sources of mercury?
The coal plants emit tremendous amounts of mercury. They're by far the largest emitters of mercury in the world. In just the U.S. alone, 48 tons of mercury a year are released by coal plants. And this is of a potent neurotoxin where, you know, one tablespoon dumped into a modest-sized lake, which is then turned into methylmercury by bacteria in the lake, and then it gets into the plants in the lake, and then the fish eat the plants, and it gets into the fish and builds up in the fish tissue. One tablespoon into a lake can make the fish in that lake unsuitable for human consumption. So this is very potent stuff. The debate on the public health issues of mercury is not whether or not mercury is a potent neurotoxin. Everyone knows that it is. But the debate now is what levels of it are okay. Is there a level of mercury that is okay? And this was also a big fight recently politically over how do we regulate mercury from coal plants. The coal industry fought very hard, and for years, first they said that, you know, the amount of mercury that comes out of coal plants isn't dangerous, and that didn't go down too well because, of course, when you have 48 tons of something coming out of coal plants, you know, it's pretty clear that's dangerous. Then they moved on to say, well, it's not our mercury that's really bad. It's the mercury that's coming out of China, because China burns a lot of coal that's full of mercury, and it gets up into the winds and is carried over to the United States, and a lot of the mercury in our lakes and rivers is really coming from China. Well, that didn't last very long because, again, the emissions from the U.S. plants are so significant. Then finally, the argument has been, well, you know, a little bit of mercury won't hurt you, and we don't think that the amount that we're putting out is really dangerous. And so they fought to implement a kind of trading system where if a company owned 5 power plants and one of them dumped out a whole lot of mercury and the other 4 didn't, or used coal that had lower amounts of mercury, you could sort of average them, and you didn't have to cut the emissions from that one that was dumping out a lot. And this was a big political fight because mercury tends to deposit locally. So if you live near a mercury emission source, because it's heavy, a significant part of it falls to the ground nearby. And so if you live near a big coal plant, the mercury levels in your waters are going to be higher than they are if you're farther away. And so the environmentalists argued that, you know, this trading system doesn't work. We need, you know, essentially a kind of catalytic converter like we have on cars for mercury on every coal plant. And this was one of the big significant battles during the Bush administration over this. And it's still not settled right now. And there are mercury regulations coming, but they're not coming as fast as some people believe that they should.
Now, has this been addressed at all on a national level in other countries, or maybe even an international level? Because I've read that, you know, aside from China, that gets, I believe, more than 70% of their electricity from coal, other countries like India, Greece, the Czech Republic, and then in some areas, you know, even as much as 95% of energy is said to come from coal, like Poland and South Africa. So are they addressing mercury issues and issues specific to coal?
No. No, they're not doing. They're not even close. I mean, we're the only ones who are doing anything, and we're not doing much. And it hasn't even. I don't even think on the radar screen in these other regions. Partly because you know there are more pressing issues for them to deal with right now, which are like, for example, in China and India, the idea of just beginning. They're just beginning to deal with the sulfur dioxide, which is the main pollutant in a lot of smog and is the main source of a lot of the particulate matter that is so dangerous from coal plants. So they're basically just beginning to deal with that, just beginning to put this quite simple scrubbers on that can help to reduce sulfur dioxide from the smokestacks. So they're essentially about where we were on cleaning up coal plants in the 1970s, in the early 70s, and so they have a long way to go before they get to mercury. And I actually don't think that, well, I don't know, but I don't think that mercury will ever really be dealt with, because I think that the problem of carbon dioxide is going to be so much bigger and more overwhelming. That's going to be the issue in the future. And the good thing about that from a control point of view is that by taking care of carbon dioxide emissions, you essentially will start to take care of a lot of mercury also. So you kind of get a two-for-one if you can do something about carbon dioxide. And that will probably be what happens with mercury in the future.
So do you think with the measures that we at least have the technology to take with scrubbers and these sorts of regulations on coal plants, if we continue to use coal to generate our electricity, will there be a way to do it in a clean fashion, essentially? I mean, obviously there are problems with how coal is extracted and what sort of toxicants are put into the local ecosystem from where it's extracted and how it's transported and things like that. But just from the use side alone, is there a way to use coal and have it be clean?
Clean coal is one of those phrases that the coal industry really likes to push hard. And it would be a really nice thing if there were a sort of magic way to clean up coal. But clean coal is sort of like a phrase like fat-free donuts or something. It's one of those phrases that, you know, sort of sounds really good but isn't really true. No, there will never be a way for coal to be clean. There will be a way for it to be cleaner. And the coal industry often talks about how the emissions from coal plants have been reduced by 70% since the 1970s, which is true and good. But there's two problems with that. One is that if your Uncle Fred calls up and, you know, says he's cut down from 10 bottles of whiskey a week to 3, that's an improvement, but it's not exactly clean and sober. And one of the reasons they've been able to cut 70% of the emissions from coal plants is because they were so filthy to begin with. And so there was certainly a lot of room to go. So even the newest coal plants that are being built today, just strictly from the point of view of air pollution, the things that we cared about and that we began to regulate in the 70s, like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides, even from those standards, they're still, you know, dirtier than their nearest rival right now, which is, you know, natural gas plant. They're a big improvement from what they used to be, but they're not clean by any stretch of the imagination. And more significantly, though, this idea of clean coal doesn't do anything about the thing that we care about most right now, which is carbon dioxide. And there are ways with new kinds of technology to perhaps capture carbon dioxide from coal plants and then pump it underground into deep saline aquifers and do other things like that. But those plants aren't being built yet, and it's not clear that they ever will be on any significant scale before new kinds of renewable energy really begins to become economically competitive. And I don't know when that tipping point is going to happen, but it's clear that there's a lot of money and interest ramping up into renewable energy in America, and I think it's not going to be long before they're not only cleaner but cheaper than coal.
And of course, you know, we're talking about sort of the supply end of things, but also when we're thinking about building up a supply, we have to consider what the demand is. And the demand in the United States has increased tremendously. You know, we believe we have a need for constant electricity to conduct our day-to-day lives, and we're seeing this increasing throughout the world, which is why people are very concerned about what we're seeing in the so-called developing world with, you know, an increased number of electric power production plants from coal and other sources, but especially from coal. So a big part of the problem here also is that we have this demand period, and you talk a fair amount in your book about how this has been really fabricated and how this was developed historically with first the development of electric power, but then the development of all sorts of, you know, widgets of every kind you can imagine.
Right. Not only that, but the, you know, the deliberate attempts over the last 100 years, you know, to encourage electricity consumption, and to, more importantly, to distance consumers from any feeling or understanding about how much electricity they really use and where it comes from. And I'm not talking just about 50 years ago. I mean, even today, most people that look at their electric bill, they have no idea what it means, what a kilowatt hour is. I mean, everyone knows what a gallon of gas is. No one knows what a kilowatt hour of electricity is. Very rarely have I ever met anyone who can tell me how many kilowatts of electricity they use in their house a month, whereas almost everyone can tell me how much gas they use in their car. We're completely distanced from our consumption of electricity, and we think of it as, you know, something that essentially comes without consequence, and it comes with a huge amount of consequence. And as you said, there's a tremendous amount of room for efficiency right now. The people who promote coal plants and all kinds of power plants say, if we don't build this coal plant or if we don't build this nuclear plant, you know, our entire economy is going to collapse and, you know, we're going to go back to living in caves. Well, you know, that's a, like a really 1960s way of looking at things, or 1970s way of looking at things. We know now that there's tremendous amounts that can be done with energy efficiency. You know, efficiency measures are by far the quickest and cheapest way of dealing with rising energy demand, and that this old paradigm of rising prosperity going in hand in hand with rising consumption not only needs to be broken, but has been broken. In California, for example, per capita electricity consumption has been essentially flat since about 1975. Because of stringent efficiency measures that have been put in place and all kinds of innovative programs. And now they're pushing forward and doing a lot more. So states like New York, we're doing some good stuff, but many states are doing very, very little. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit still out there on just reducing demand. And by doing this, I don't mean, you know, the Jimmy Carter thing of, you know, turn down your thermostat and put on a sweater and sit there and shiver on your couch. And I mean by just tougher building standards, appliance standards, compact fluorescent bulbs. There's a zillion things that can be done and easily done to reduce consumption.
So really there are opportunities for action at federal levels in terms of regulations and state levels, of course, for regulations, but also, you know, at the more local level among our families and communities and in our homes as well, and the choices we make on a day-to-day basis, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Well, Jeff, thank you for joining us today on Public Health Radio. You've been very informative, and we've really enjoyed having you as a guest.
Well, good. Well, thanks very much. I appreciate your having me.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of Public Health Radio. For more information about the show and to download a copy of this or our other recordings of Public Health Radio, please visit us online at www.publichealthradio.org. That's all one word, publichealthradio.org. Today's show was produced by myself, Dr. Andrew Coates, and engineered by Dr. Gerald Sahavi. Thank you.